This is tape two of the Bob Traxler interview. When the last tape ended, we were talking about decision to run for the MSU board.
Is this tape three?
Tape two. It was the second side.
Okay.
This is.
Thank you.
1 hour is done.
That's why I'm not doing oral interviews. As I was saying, that decision was based on several factors. One, what do I do with my life after Congress? Two, how can I still serve the public? And I didn't want anything to do with partisan politics. Mm-hmm. Didn't want elected office. I wasn't going to be engaged, so to speak. And I thought that by going to academia, it would be the perfect kind of a slow build down to a settled life where I could still be involved in public policy, but at a much higher level than I'd participated in, shall we say, in elective office, partisan office, even though MSU is, quote, they're elected and nominated in a partisan fashion. Mm-hmm. Little did I know what awaited me. In fact, I was there. The other reason that I wanted to be on the MSU board was my deep affection and love for the university, and I owed it a great deal. It had been very formative in my development of my persona and my education, my development of my philosophical views of the proper society, and I thought it was payback time. Mm-hmm. So I looked forward to that. Mm-hmm. I think I was there something like 4 months, 5 months, had been to a couple board meetings, and announced I wasn't going to seek re-election. This was not a place for me. You come to, you go to the to a university after having been in elective office, I think especially the Congress, and especially having been what's referred to as a member of the College of Cardinals. Mm-hmm. And you go to a university board where boards really don't matter, and you think that you're going to be involved in policy and voting on issues of some importance, and you discover, first thing, nobody wants to vote on any issue. The next thing is, no one, including most of the members of the board, want to make policy. And thirdly, all the above, plus the only thing I'm interested in is athletics. So I didn't want to be a do-nothing trustee. Mm-hmm. And that's why I said I'm not going to run for re-election. Mm-hmm. And everybody kind of looked at me and said, oh, well, this guy, who's he kidding? They can't, well, most of my colleagues can't imagine a life after the university. Mm-hmm. Most of them all seek re-election. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And for them, it's, you know, it's the beginning and the end of everything.
Mm-hmm. You were right at the end of Dr. DiBiagio left, and then mm-hmm. the search.
Yeah, Gordon was Gordon the acting president. I tried to get Gordon to stay on uh-huh. for a couple of years, at least one. I said, Gordon, you're in an ideal position to make the necessary changes here and to leave this place for the next president well-structured. And he looked at me and he said, Bob, I've spent my entire life at Michigan State University. All these people are my friends, and I'm not going to disturb that relationship. Mm-hmm. I said, even doing what needs to be done. Mm-hmm. He said, that's the job of the next president. Mm-hmm.
Okay, we're talking about the early years, Gordon Guyer was acting president when you
yes.
first came to,
yes.
came to the board.
Yes.
And then you said that he didn't want to continue on as president.
Yeah. And I was a freshman mm-hmm. on the board mm-hmm. my first year, and I became chairman of the search committee. Mm. I didn't know what I was doing. But we had a good committee in many respects, but the secretary to the committee was Bruce was from the philosophy department.
Okay.
He'd been at MSU for a number of years.
Miller?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Bruce was looking forward within a few years to retirement. Very even person, very even personality, and totally devoted to the institution. Very helpful. I had formed an alliance with the three Republicans with a commitment that we would look for a strong academic person to come in as president of the university. And of course, there were a lot of problems. I mean, you got so many different stakeholders. When this whole president, the appointment of a president comes up, every one of the stakeholders wants their person as president. The faculty would like a strong academic who's had experience teaching and research. The minorities want one of theirs, whether it's black, Hispanic, Asian. Other factors are, is the president strong, is this candidate strong on athletics? Mm-hmm. Is he going to do justice to our academic or our sports traditions at this university, or is he one of those fuzzy-haired thinkers who is focused on academics and doesn't care less about football? So there were these confrontations done quietly, but differences of opinion as to really what kind of a person we wanted. And the then construction, interpretation of the Open Meetings Act really hurt the search process. The media doesn't believe this, but more importantly, they don't care. They don't want to believe it. And even if they did believe it, it's irrelevant. And we don't care what kind of president you got. We want to be sitting in that room and listen to every bit of gossip that comes out on that nominee, mm-hmm. each and every one of them. We want access to every report you got on them and on her, and we want to know what size underwear they wear. And it's just an impossible, it was an impossible process. Well, the search committee recommended, or we were going to have, three invitees for a public appearance, interviews, public interviews. And one of the three was a chap, an MSU graduate, whose sister-in-law had served on the board as a trustee several years ago. And he was a mathematics major, and he was the president of Florida State University. And he had been president of two previous institutions, one in the Mid-Atlantic, I think South Carolina, maybe a private school, I'm not sure, and also a university in Maine, and struck me as exactly the kind of person we were looking for. Came out of, I mean, clearly at Florida State, a large university, land-grant institution, and strong in athletics, which was important to a number of members of the board. And I thought, with his academic background, I was especially mathematics, I was very impressed with that. I thought this was just ideal. What happened was he got sabotaged by some of the stakeholder organizations. Mm-hmm. And he was accused of racism, and there was no way. They wanted to wipe him out, hoping that their favorite candidate would rise to the surface then, whoever that happened to be. So he got wiped out. And that presented an opportunity to put forward a candidate who hadn't made the preliminary cut. And that was McPherson. McPherson had as his allies the governor, unknown to me at that point, and one of the governor's best friends who had known McPherson. They were both students at MSU. And that was McClellan, Richard McClellan. And McClellan was able to move several Democrat trustees into McPherson's camp, and McPherson sort of appeared very, very suddenly. It was just at the tail end of the process, and the search committee recommended him. And I wasn't the chairman of the search committee. I had resigned in it because I so strongly believed in keeping this process a congenial one. I wanted to get off the search committee to comply with the Open Meetings Act so that we'd have no more than four members on the search committee of the board, four members of the Board of Trustees. Mm-hmm. And I got off so the search committee could meet in private. That's the way the law was interpreted then. Of course, mm-hmm. it's quite different. Now the Supreme Court has said you don't have to have open meetings for mm-hmm. the selection of a president. Mm-hmm. Thank heavens. And
did you take flack at the time in the press? Did you take a lot of flack?
I took that position during my election. Okay. Mm-hmm. I just said the Open Meetings Act is as being applied today is unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. I had argued that in the board when we got involved in litigation. The question was, should we appeal the decision of the Court of Appeals on this issue? We'd won at the circuit court level and lost at the Court of Appeals level. The president was very nervous about this because he was afraid that if we went to the Supreme Court, they would affirm the Court of Appeals and he'd sort of be out in Never Never Land, mm-hmm. having been quote-unquote selected improperly. Mm-hmm. Well, he didn't want that kind of publicity. He's very, very conscious of, he's got a very thin skin. Mm-hmm. So I persuaded the board. It was very interesting that the Constitution is very clear in this regard and that we had as a matter of responsibilities aboard to uphold both the Constitution and our duties as trustees for the selection of the president, we had to appeal. And finally, the president realized that and climbed on board our express train. Mm-hmm. And we were successful in the Supreme Court. That's the interpretation of the law today. Well, the night of that the board met to consider McPherson's presidency. Well, first off, my three Republican friends abandoned me. They got calls from the governor and McClellan. McClellan lined up two Democrats on the board. He didn't have to line up Joel. Joel already cut a deal with the governor on this issue, and Joel got what he wanted out of the governor. The two Democrat women were both state employees, and they were in a precarious position, obviously. So they supported McPherson's presidency, and all three Republicans did too, of course. Mm-hmm. And Bob Weiss and myself voted no. And made it clear that there's nothing personal in this. It was just simply, in our best judgment, the process had failed, and that number two, the candidate lacked the qualifications to be president and wasn't the appropriate kind of a person that we wanted at that point in time for the presidency. So that's how McPherson came to MSU.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In some of those early years, what were the issues that you've had to face as a board?
Well, each of the board really doesn't go out and initiate mm-hmm. a process. I argued, for instance, that we ought to change the bylaws and provide that I was procedure-oriented as well as substance. And I felt that the secretary of the board ought to be appointed by the Board of Trustees. which put me at considerable odds with the president and all administrators who were just were terrorized at the thought that the board might have an inside representative. And I was told this could never work. The secretary would be ignored, would not be in on any of the decisions. They said, it doesn't matter now. She's in or out. She's serving two masters. The president appoints her or recommends her. We can, under our bylaws, he makes a recommendation. We approve or disapprove. And I said, you've never disapproved. It won't happen, even though I voted no on every secretary that came before us for a vote. No, not because I didn't think they'd do a good job or had some problem with them. It was simply the process was flawed. And if I am constitutionally held accountable for what happens at the university, my judgment was that I ought to be involved in the policy issues. And that distressed administrators to no end. And boards are supposed to be seldom seen and never heard from. And I think this is a... I don't think this is a unique phenomenon to MSU. I think, though, it's probably accentuated at MSU because we've had a history of strong, by and large, strong presidents going back to John Hanna, who originated it all. I think there was concerted efforts during my years on the board to provide members with those things that the member of the trustees, a member of the board, was most interested in. And generally speaking, that would involve question as to who ran the athletic department. Bob and Joel was always vying for that title. And if there's any landmine that a president is constantly aware of, it's the issue of athletics. And I think for some other members, they had different views as to why they didn't want to behave as a trustee, but rather wanted to be known as a cooperative, supportive, non-engaged trustee. And that would those reasons and would vary from one to another. One would like the attention of being a confidant of the president, whoever the president was, DiBiagio. Mm-hmm. She was a very good friend of DiBiagio's, very good friend of McPherson's, and couldn't see the role of trustee as a policy-making position in which you could be original and creative and business-like. My sense is that the election process of trustees is not a suitable way to bring people to the board at MSU. I think Michigan is much more successful in having people of judgment and understanding of the role that that this regent plays. Because a regent is indeed a trustee, and the definition of trusteeship really is one that at Michigan State I think has, by and large, failed. I think Michigan is much better governed than Michigan State from the standpoint they have a better board. Mm-hmm. Not that the people at Michigan State aren't gifted and talented. That's not the issue. The issue is that historically at Michigan State, all effort is made to subvert the board and turn it into lapdog. That doesn't work at Michigan. They don't have that tradition. Mm-hmm. And indeed, their last president, not the present one, but the last president before this one, lost his position because of failure to advise the board on several important questions and acting unilaterally. Mm-hmm. That hasn't happened ever at Michigan State. And I'll salute the day that it does. Mm-hmm. I had some interest in I think the role, I think unfortunately, having served on the Appropriations Committee in the Congress, a place where there's immense amounts of tradition and incredibly gifted staff, and where you're focused on just a couple of agencies, and you hold extensive hearings with the agency people coming before you, and you ask them, what'd you do with the money we gave you last year? And what is it you want for next year, the next cycle of appropriations? And we have careful review of what they said the year before. You have extensive comparisons in the finances as to where the money went over a period of time. Even though you're dealing in billions, it soon adds up, as the old saying goes. I think that questioning, no matter who was before you, whether it was a president of your party or president of the other party, nominees and appointees that were before you, gave an appropriate sense to a member of the committee that the role of the Congress as appropriators and as policymakers is one that's vital to the success of the democratic process. And when presidents ignore the law, you get things happening like Watergate and Iran-Contra. And it behooves those bodies which have a constitutional responsibility to perform their tasks in keeping with the objective of check and balance. And, you know, Lord Acton said that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. That is an axiom that no one ever ought to forget. It holds just as true in a university setting as it does in some other governmental setting. And it's essential that there be a balance, a check to administration power. Otherwise, it will soon turn into a corrupt organization. So I viewed my period as a trustee of one as kind of a watchdog. One, are they following all the rules? Are they doing what we've instructed them to do? Are they following the policies that have been long established here? Number one. Number two, what are policies that we need that will enhance our watchdog role? And what can the Board of Trustees be doing by way of policy that will assure that the highest degree of fiscal and ethical accountability exists at the university? The budgeting process, having come from almost 20 years in budgeting, the budgeting process basically leaves out the Board of Trustees. Principally, they're rubber stamps. Mm-hmm. The question on development of policy is very much a mixed bag. And the board isn't as, it's better in terms of policy than it is in terms of budgeting. Of course, budgeting in itself is policy. I mean, where you put the money is a very important policy decision. Mm-hmm. But in terms of policy, for instance, there were a number of areas in which that business practices were just, good business practices were just ignored. Mm-hmm. I strongly believed in what I refer to as requests for proposals. I firmly believe in periodically shifting vendors. I think that the buddy relationship that develops between university officials and people who are selling to the university is not conducive to getting the biggest return for your dollar spent. And that eternal vigilance is necessary when you're dealing with money. You need internal controls that are workable and working. You need good independent auditors. You need your auditors within the university need and this was something that I firmly believed in, I felt that, the board should appoint our internal auditor, and that that auditor had the responsibility of reporting back to the board, both in terms of the fiscal matters of the university and how the money was being spent and who spent it, but also in terms of were the policies that boards, previous boards had adopted, were they being followed? That concept of having a board that, appointed internal auditors was absolutely chilling to the administrators and especially the president. The idea that a university official would be accountable to the board and not directly to the president, where you filter it through these layers of bureaucrats and finally gets to the board and it's so sanitized, you'd think you'd arrived in heaven. Mm-hmm. So, I made the case for that. There was one or two people on the board knew what I was talking about and were sympathetic towards it. But as one of the guys said to me, he said, "Bob, when and if you got four votes, I'll be your fifth." And that's the way it was. And I had some other hopes. I was very distressed the way in which our travel was handled at the university. We had a preferred travel agency, mm-hmm. which had the contracts with the university for more years than anybody could remember. And I often wondered, is this really the best way in which to spend over $20 million a year on airlines and car rentals and housing? Is there a way in which we can be assured that we are getting the biggest value for our dollar? And I had a personal experience that really scared me in terms of the way things were done. I'd been on the board about, I think, 2 years, maybe. Yeah, just no more than that. And maybe a year and a half. And Michigan State was playing in a basketball regional tournament in Tampa, Florida. And I had contemplated going down for that game. And I asked one of the secretaries at the board to make some flight reservations for me. And I looked at the reservations. I said, "This is crazy. What a weird schedule this is. I'm flying through Pittsburgh to go to Orlando? That don't make any sense. Especially when I was paying $1,200 round trip." And I said to her, how does this get done? What is this?" And she said, "Well, it's made by our travel people." I said, "Oh, those preferred travel people, yeah." And they said there are no flights, no seats available on Northwest Airlines the way you wanted to go. I said, "Really?" I said, "That's incredible. Okay." So I called Northwest, because I'd always flown Northwest to and from Washington for almost 20 years. Mm-hmm. So I knew a little bit about their booking system. And so I just called them direct and said, "Look, I want to go to Orlando. I looked at the timetable. I said, "Here are the flights I want. Tri-City Airport to Detroit, Detroit to Orlando, Orlando back to Detroit and up to Tri-City. Mm-hmm. Here are the flight numbers." She said, "Yes, sir, we got you plugged in." I said, "Very interesting." Mm-hmm. And it was the same fare. Mm-hmm. Now, generally speaking, if you have a layover, see, the way the travel agent was sending me was Orlando to Pittsburgh to Detroit to Tri-City. Okay? Now, generally, with that kind of a roundabout, you get the cheapest fare. Mm-hmm. The more stops you make, cheaper it gets, mm-hmm. and it ought to. We all know that. And mm-hmm. I was very irritated, because they were charging $1,200. I had $1,200 ticket. Mm-hmm. I thought, where is the difference going? If the university's paying $1,200 either way, mm-hmm. and I knew that going through Pittsburgh was a cheaper ticket, who got the advantage on that? Well, of course, the travel agent did. Mm-hmm. I thought, that's a hell of a way to run an airport, a railroad. And so, one of the things that over a period of several years, I was able to achieve was an agreement on the part of the administration that they would do an RFP for travel. And I thought, I can't believe this. This is an incredible event.
You changed your bureaucracy.
First time. My God, a trustee has actually proposed policy that the administration is buying, because out of hand they reject trustees' policy initiatives. I mean, it's a dangerous precedent, and you have to kill that sucker instantly before it comes out of the nest, because it could spread. It's kind of like a disease. And we can't allow trustees to think that they have any role in policy. So I was utterly amazed. And then we sat down at a board meeting. Actually, it wasn't a board meeting. It was really our every other month briefing session. And we went over the request for proposal. I got down in the fine print, and it said, local providers will be given preference. Oh, my God, this is incredible. What are you people doing? You take us for fools? And so immediately after I chastised them, the president said, well, we'll take that out. And I said, you know, it doesn't matter anymore. It's over. I know what you're going to do. The same people that got it now are going to have it after the RFP, and they submit,